This podcast is brought to you by Amusement Warehouse Magazine, the industry's largest trade publication. We cover amusement parks, carnivals, fairs, festivals, history, safety columns. We really got it all when it comes to the amusement business. Only remaining print publication in the amusement industry on a regular basis. So if you're interested in what the amusement industry has to offer, subscribe today. You can subscribe by logging on to amusementwarehouse.com, carnivalwarehouse.com, or amusementparkwarehouse.com. Welcome to another edition of the Amusement Warehouse Podcast. Today we welcome members of the Skirbeck family, which is got to be one of the oldest, longest running carnivals in the country, probably just about anywhere, at least in North America. Welcome. We have Joe and Bill and Arlene Skirbeck, right, today?
Arlene Altenberg.
I'm sorry?
Her last name is Altenberg.
Altenberg. Okay. So we don't have all seven generations, but close.
Well, we're not the second. We're the fifth.
We're the fifth.
I was just teasing.
He's four.
That's amazing. Yeah. So your history is just amazing. Can you tell us, when you started? It was you started the circus business, I guess, and how you sort of came to be as a carnival.
Well, it started in Europe in 1857, and my our great grandfather had a circus over there. The story was that he traded a linen factory for a one ring circus. And his son, Frank.
Is that a good deal, or is that like trading Manhattan for some beans?
I don't know. I don't know what kind of linen factory it was, and I don't know.
We got the beans.
And anyhow, he came over to America in 1876 as an acrobat. He left his family back there. He worked for Barnum, P.T. Barnum show for a season, and then he went back and liked America, and he convinced his wife and to come over. So they came over, the boat left in 1883 and arrived in the port of Baltimore, and they had bought some land, or got some land probably for nothing or next to nothing, up in central Wisconsin on a railroad. It was part of the railroad right-of-ways that they were selling to get immigrants in. So he thought he was getting a vineyard is what he was getting. He got 40 acres of uncleared land. So they cleared the land, put up a house and a barn, and started practicing their acts. And they went on the road in 1884, I believe, was the first year.
And that's pretty fascinating. So they didn't have any circus background, though? So they had to, like, learn how to do everything?
No, they were performers over there. My grandfather, Joe, was 9 years old when he came over. Five kids by that time. And then when they got here, they had three or four more. But they were all seasoned performers, if you can be
a seasoned performer. Oh, they were, okay. Performer. I was wondering about the linen factory, if they were, doing backflips in the back.
Linen factory was out of the business by 57. So anyhow, they were in the circus business for a long time. In 1893, they were hired to perform at the World's Fair in Chicago. So they did that for several weeks. And they went broke a lot. 1893 was a big panic, and they lost the show several times, but they kept coming back to it. It's like they went broke, it seemed, almost every year for a dozen years, or longer even. But they'd come back, they'd either, in the wintertime, if they were broke, they'd do music halls. Later, they do vaudeville shows in the wintertime. And they did all kinds of stuff besides the circus. For a while, they were doing Uncle Tom's Cabin. One time, they lost the circus and a blowdown. So they went to the spots that they had booked and did a play. It was Uncle Tom's Cabin. It's kind of the story of the book. And they also did balloon ascensions for free acts, hot air balloons.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and the balloon would go up in the air, and they had a trapeze dangling from the basket, and they'd do some acts on that, and then parachute down to the earth.
We need stuff like that now. Is there any interest in getting back in that? No.
Sometimes I think about it.
Yeah. Some of the acts are pretty boring in the fairs right now. We need a balloon trapeze thing. That'd be great. Yeah.
But my great-grandfather bought his first merry-go-round in 1897. It was a steam, okay. A steam engine merry-go-round.
Did he make it himself, or was it a manufacturer?
Well, my dad bought it from someplace. He kept it a couple of years, and then he sold it. And then he bought another one in the early 1900s, 1904 or 5, I think, and got back into it with that one.
Now, where would he operate that? Would he bring it to some of these dates, or just?
No, well, he'd play single O. He'd like go to some town, like just find out if he could put it up in the city park, and they'd put it up in the park, and they'd let him keep all the money. So, but it was kind of a hard piece to move.
They did that in conjunction with the circus at that time, right?
No, because the circus would move every day or, you know, every 2 days at merry-go-round. They'd set it up and leave it for a couple of weeks, I think.
Okay. As long as the people kept paying, I guess. They.
Yeah. When they tapped everybody out, they found the greener pastures.
Or they get like a nickel or something to ride the thing.
Exactly right. I still got a pass for that merry-go-round, a free pass. It's framed in our office.
Probably had wood horses too. You wish you had those, I imagine.
We had a Parker 1921 Parker machine when I was a little boy, and Bill was a boy too then. And that one we should have kept, but we didn't have space for it, so we sold it for a song. And each one of those horses was worth what we paid for it.
Yeah, but when it was sold, that value wasn't there.
So no,
shortly thereafter. But you know, hindsight's 20/20.
Yeah, I just interviewed Jimmy Drew. He still has a merry-go-round with wooden horses he puts up once in a while.
Yeah.
Jimmy Drew's got
like armed guards there overnight. I would. Horses. That's crazy. But
Well, my Uncle George had a merry-go-round he had put up at Glidden, Wisconsin, and left it there in the wintertime. And somebody did come out and steal the wooden horses out of that. It was kind of a... in a pavilion that had canvas around them. When they went back in the spring, the horses were all gone.
Oh, no. Yeah. They're so valuable now. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. So he had the merry-go-round, and then he bought another merry-go-round for a while.
Right. And then I don't know what happened to that merry-go-round. He wound up traveling. My great-grandfather traveled with his daughter, Amanda.
Carob.
And actually, he died on a merry-go-round. He was, they were playing.
Knows that story.
In Oshkosh, Wisconsin, right?
Right. Go ahead and tell it.
Well, no, that's all I know.
Oh, well.
That was a good meeting, though.
Well, he was sitting on the ride, and in those days, merry-go-rounds had conductors that whistle, blow, whistle to start and stop the ride. And then the conductor would go around and get the tickets usually. But he said it would be the last ride of the night. To the operator and sat down. It was a very long ride. They thought our great grandfather had fallen asleep, and they stopped the ride to wake him up, but he had passed away. And that's a perfect way for a showman to go out.
Yeah, that's crazy. I never heard a story like that before.
Yeah, that's true.
And another true story is our great uncle Antoine was doing a clown act with Grandpa Joe and another Uncle Gus is another one of his brothers. And they had a slap board. They slapped him, you know, across the backside, and he went down, but they knew something was different that time. So they knew he was dying. He had an aneurysm. And they carried him off of the stage, out of the ring and into the back of the circus tent, and called a priest and had his last rites and never revived. And he was a young man. He was in his 20s.
That's sad. That's really sad. Mm-hmm. So was the, did they combine a little bit of the merry-go-round and the circus acts together?
No, I think, I don't think they ever, because the circus moves too quick, you know.
Yeah.
Even today, not today, but even when they were 40 years ago or 60 years ago, I don't think too many carnivals, they might day and date sometimes. The circus didn't own the rides, I don't believe. Maybe they
had a merry-go-round, and when did it become more of an organized carnival? Did he get shows eventually? Or?
Well, there were actually three carnivals started out of that show. There's White Amusements, who was my Aunt Pearl's show, and that started in probably in the late teens. My grandfather, our grandfather had started with rides probably in 1913 or 14. And then Amanda Skirbeck Carup had a show out. And it's funny, you know, both those shows are still around playing kind of the same route because Pearl White's show got bought by my mother's brother. And it's still on the road in Wisconsin, A&P Enterprise shows. And Chrisman's shows in Wisconsin is the show that our Aunt Mandy had.
Caribou Amusements.
Wow. You guys spawned most of the carnivals out that way. In one way or another. So there weren't that many rides though then, so they had to add some shows, right, for a carnival?
Yeah. Our mother started joining the show with her dad had a mechanical sawmill show, and it was a walkthrough show. So why don't you tell them what Skirbeck shows look like in 39 the first year?
You played with them? Yes.
Tilt-a-whirl?
Oh, yeah, Tilt-a-whirl, Ferris wheel, merry-go-round. A couple kid rides.
Swing ride?
Yeah, a couple kiddie rides. And that was 1939. And my sister, we were playing Tomahawk, Wisconsin, or the Skirbeck shows. And my dad and mother were with them. We were with them. And so anyway, my mother was pregnant and we raced, my dad and mother and myself and my sister Margaret, we raced from Tomahawk to our home in Polonia, Wisconsin, and my sister Pauline was born. And that was quite an event because of the nature of having to travel all that time.
In 1939.
Yeah,
And then a year later, her brother Jack was born. Yeah, John was born in the trailer while they were playing the fair in Wasaukee, Wisconsin.
Yeah,
the doctor came out and delivered him in the trailer they were living in.
Yeah, Dr. Horswell delivered him. And he came over every day while we were at the fair to visit, to see how my mom was and the baby.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah. And then we made a long trip all the way across Wisconsin to Eau Claire, where the Chippewa. And my mother rode in a trailer, and I rode with her. My dad he pulled a trailer, and he had two of my siblings in a car with him. So anyway, it was quite an event then, and then Skirbeck shows had, they had events there in Chippewa Falls.
Chippewa Falls.
Yeah.
That's where Rick Furnett's from.
Right. Quite a few decades later, I think, though.
He's just a small baby. That's neat. So you had a big Wisconsin base back then. How did you wind up migrating to Michigan?
Well, the story my mother told me was, and I remember it because I was 10 years old at the time. They had a nice route in Wisconsin, and a fair promoter or some promoter in Milwaukee wanted to open an amusement park south of town. And it never materialized. But so my dad, in the meantime, had given up the route, found somebody else to play a route so they could go down there with their rides and play in the park. So that fell through, and then they had to scurry around and they booked spots in Lower Michigan. And
yeah, that's how we got started in Michigan.
And that was before the bridge was built, so we had to take the car ferry across with the
Straits of Mackinac. Mm-hmm.
To go from up to Lower Michigan. And they put together a route down there. And
shame you didn't take pictures of that. That must have been some sight watching the carnival go across the...
Oh, I think
probably
I
have some somewhere, yeah.
We played real small spots, like... and then we did have two fares that we booked. So we were, or three, was it? Anyway, we at least had something to hang on to.
Yeah. Sort of a base to start your route at.
Exactly.
Yeah. Build your route around.
So
what were the carnivals that were in Michigan at that time? What year was that about, too?
That would have been 56.
Waitrose when Glenn Wade.
World of Pleasure, but Rod Linkton owned it. Yeah. Then Johnny Quinn owned it.
Johnny Reed's Happy Land shows.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the big show. And Charlie Lee had a show. There's Wolverine shows. There's a lot of them.
Motor State.
Motor State.
Cook.
Cook Amusements, right?
Cook Amusements.
Frank Cook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I guess Gooding didn't go to Michigan, did they? Floyd Gooding, he was an Ohio guy only.
No, it was Michigan. There might have been more common name. I think there might have been another family in Ohio.
No, Floyd Gooding. Gooding's music.
Yeah, Gooding. I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
Yeah,
did they go to Michigan or were they just in Ohio?
No, he played a lot of fairs in Michigan. He played.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, he played Saginaw County Fair. He played Shiawassee County Fair. Hillsdale County Fair, St. Joseph's County Fair. He had a nice
elegant. Mission.
Yeah, elegant at one time.
Adrian, probably. All the southern counties.
They had a bunch of units, right? Gooding's.
Yeah, 10 or 12, I think. If you look at an old AB from, or the billboard from the 1950s.
Yeah. Somebody tell me stories about how he would, you know, he'd have a suite or whatever at the Ohio Convention and the committees would just wait to go in to see him to find out when their date would be.
They were all started in the middle of the week and ended in the middle of the following.
Did he start that? That's such a weird practice sometimes.
Nobody else could jump in there and play those dates.
I guess you're right, right? Because I've encountered a couple of those over the years, and I wonder, like, why do you start on Tuesday? It's the craziest thing. You're like, I don't know.
We played Springfield, Ohio, Clark County Fair down there for probably 8 years or so.
Opened Saturday and closed Friday.
So we had to give up two fairs to play it.
Yeah, you got to give up two weekends. That's insane.
Yeah. That's,
and it's funny because a lot of the fairs, they won't budge on it.
They wouldn't.
It's crazy, right? You're just looking at it like, am I on Mars or something? What am I not following? You close on a Friday.
Well, we can all thank Mr. Gooding for that.
So
that's an interesting strategy. It's an interesting strategy. Yeah. So when you... when you guys got involved, were you both on the same show at first?
Yeah, let me tell you, back up a little bit. My grandfather and grandmother sold the show to my dad and my aunt Pauline, and they were partners. My mother was too, in 1952, I think.
Yeah, right.
And then they formed a corporation, Skirbeck Amusement Company, and that operated until 1971 through 71. And then I run the show by myself for a couple of years. And then Bill and I, Bill and I became partners. And we started Skirbeck Brothers Shows. And that operated.
In 1975.
Yeah, and that operated for 40 seasons. And then, but in the meantime in there, we had bought Doug Clark's Leisure Time Shows. So we had two separate shows, basically. And I retired in 2015 was the year I didn't have a show anymore. I sold it there to our children.
Okay.
My part of it. We had split it up. We'd split the corporation up.
Yeah, it's easier when you have your own companies, when you have the kids involved and everybody else, it makes it.
That was the driving force.
Well, the Bavonas kind of are doing it. The cousins are all, you know, involved and doing pretty good together with the, you mentioned 1939. That's when the World's Fair was, when they bought the Ferris wheel and got started. It's
what, is that right? I didn't
know. Yeah, they bought the Ferris wheel in 1939 World's Fair.
Okay.
So they could promote their ice cream truck. So that's great. So, so you guys worked together for what, how many years? 40 years. Yeah. Wow. And how many units did you have?
Two was the base. Sometimes we'd have three or four out, but usually two.
Yeah, we had one show until 96. In 1996, we bought Leisure Time Shows, which was operating in Michigan. And we bought that from Doug Clark, and then I went with that, you know, that show to man, to, you know, take care of it, manage it, and Bill stayed with the original Skrbik Brothers shows to manage that. But we didn't use the Leisure Time title after when we bought it. We went to Skrbik Brothers with both shows.
And still have some spots you played for 40, 50 years or more?
I go to the Dickinson County Fair, which is up here in the UP, and we've been going there for...
Since 42.
42, 1942. The family has, so quite a while. So I always tell them they can sign a contract with someone else, but I'm pulling the trucks in on Labor Day weekend, so they might as well sign it with me.
And you still play the Upper Peninsula State Fair?
Yeah. That's our hometown, so we do a good job here, really good job.
That's great. That's great. So when you first got the show, like how many rides did you start with in 75 or whatever it was?
I was thinking of it as a 12.
Yeah, probably 12.
I think so. Yes.
Yeah. We had 12 rides in 1975. And when we split up in 2014, we had 50 rides. So we grew quite a bit. There were some duplicates in there, two tilts, two
swings,
two wheels, but we grew quite large. And then we're back down. I carry 25 rides, and I'm not sure what.
I think it's over 30.
Over 30. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
So 50 some rides. It's
yeah. It's all good.
An incredible difference.
And all and again. So it'd be another, you know, 40 games between the two shows.
And Miss Arlene, the rides, how they've grown over time, it must be just amazing for you to watch, because it was in your lifetime you went from just a handful of rides to some amazing machines now that they're selling and using. I'm not sure if she can hear me, but
yeah, I think she can. I think she's agreeing with what you said, that it is amazing how the technology is made everything so much more fascinating.
What about the prices?
Well, it's all relative, isn't it?
To a certain extent. To a certain extent.
Yeah. It's crazy now, but that's what it is. So
I can't believe some of the number. I was like a major ride from a manufacturer that, you know, even I don't know, 20 years ago I knew what the price was. And I asked them, not this give them, but last one. I just couldn't believe it. I mean, it's like triple what it was. It's incredible. Just incredible.
Well, in the 70s, a new ride, you could buy a spectacular for what, $25,000,
$28,000? I think Skywheels were like $80,000.
$80,000.
Like in the late 60s, early 70s. Yeah. That's after Chance started making them.
Yeah. Who did Chance invent the Skywheel? Were they the first? Alan Herschel, right?
Curtis and Elmer Valeri.
Oh, Valeri. Okay.
Invented it, and then they... Alan Herschel started building them for him under their license.
Yeah, he beefed it up, I think, a little bit or something. I know he did that with Jimmy Drew's Space Wheels. He they made the first one, and then they sent it to Alan Herschel, and he made it beefier, more steel, more everything to make it, because that's the one Jimmy Drew has now, I think, mm-hmm. is the one that Alan Herschel redesigned, I guess you'd say.
Well, I heard the first year that Elmer and Curtis had that ride on the road, they took it on the road, they only played a few fairs, and they had to put concrete footings down because it'd come in on a half dozen trailers or so, and they'd, you know, put it up. It was like constructing the mini Eiffel Tower.
Those guys were incredible for their time. I think it was also Jimmy Drew that told me that Villari had said that he was sad that he was, you know, he's getting older, that the technology was just really coming into being where he could really do some incredible things, you know, with the things they did with the technology they had is just fascinating, because they built some incredible attractions with the Space Wheel and the Seattle Wheel and all that sort of thing. What for Miss Arlene, what ride were you most like amazed by that you saw for the first time? Which one really blew your mind?
Tilt-A-Whirl
was a big deal, huh?
Yeah, yes. But you know, when my husband and I started, when we bought our Tilt-A-Whirl in 1952, I think, somewhere in there, we bought the Tilt on payments. And so, in other words, we were sending checks in every week of the percentage of what the Tilt took in. So finally we didn't get it paid off not that year, but a couple of years later. So anyhow, the Tilt was it still is today, because the kids and mothers can ride it together. And they really, you know, it's a family ride.
Yeah, it gives a little bit of thrill, and yet it's still not too crazy where, it, you know, you're not going to not want to ride it.
Yes.
So that was a big game changer with the show, was that something like the Tilt was a big deal.
Back in 1952 it was, you bet.
That's my friend Avery Wheelock has... he said when his grandfather bought a scrambler the first time, he brought it to a fair and they had a parade for it. They were so excited to get the scrambler. It was such a big deal to bring it into town that they had a whole parade to celebrate their purchase of the scrambler and bringing it up out to the fairgrounds.
What year did Pauline get hers?
1956, I think. 57.
Yeah.
I think she had the number 6 or number 8 model scrambler, and it was so popular, so hot in those years, that people were contacting her, willing to pay her X amount of money above her purchase price just to get her production year, her production model, I should say.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but she kept...
I wonder how many they were putting out a year.
Well, I don't know that. I don't know that.
The carnival in Wisconsin has got that Tilt yet.
Oh, really?
Wait.
The scrambler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The scrambler.
I think it was Larky or somebody bought it, didn't they?
Probably.
Those are big. Well, and it was good to have some, I guess being in the Midwest, it was nice to have from Minnesota and from Illinois, some Midwest manufacturers too. They were not too far away. You could.
Yeah, there were a lot more manufacturers than.
Yeah.
Even, you know, even a company, whether it's Ellen Herschel, who made a lot of rides, Chance made a lot of rides, in the 60s and 70s, and then by the 1990s, they weren't making hardly any carnival rides anymore. The Zippers, once in a while, he makes yet. But it's, and now with the tariffs, it's going to be interesting to see what the American prices are. If you got to pay 25% more for a European ride, I imagine the domestic manufacturers will increase their prices accordingly. So it's going to be kind of interesting.
It's not that much. You know, you got Batek, and you got, I was talking to Rocky Mountain Coaster, who bought
Larson.
And Selner, the Selner assets too. But they haven't made a Tilt-A-Whirl in a while. I'm kind of surprised, because I don't know if it's because they're not like making it known that they make them or what it is, but you think you'd sell a Tilt, you know, to someone.
I don't think they've been making too many new Tilts when Larson had it even. I think it's mostly parts
business.
People rebuild their Tilts.
Yeah, but still, you think you'd sell a couple, you know, to someone.
Yeah, it's a good ride. They last forever. If you buy it, you can keep it for 60 years.
Same with the Scrambler. I interviewed Patty Sullivan in Gibtown, and I was going to ask her, do you regret making the Scrambler so well? Because it never breaks, you know. You buy one, and then you're good for life, just about.
She's still selling them because they're made them portable. I mean, they're quite a bit easier to move than a tilt-a-whirl with what she's done on the trailer mounting. And they really didn't do that. They tried it on the tilt. They had one model out. And then
The Electric 7 or whatever they called it.
The Electric 7, but that's still a ground mount ride.
Oh, I see what you're saying, with the trailer mount. Okay.
Yeah, they took a Scrambler where two people can set it up and tear it down, as opposed to a tilt where you still need four people to do it efficiently.
Yeah, I used to have a guy that worked for me. He said that the tilt-a-whirl is the worst ride to be a foreman of, because you get paid like a major foreman, but really it's the work of a spectacular, you know, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, if a guy was 6'6 and weighed 300 pounds, you would say he's our tilt man.
He's our tilt man. Yeah. So now the ride with 50 or so rides, what kind of equipment do you have? What kind of wheel do you have? And equipment-wise, what do you have?
Well, my family, my wife CJ and myself and Bobby, Dustin, and Carly, we have a
Century wheel. You're a Skirbeck family, and you're...
Yeah, we're a Skirbeck family. And we have a Century wheel that my brother and I bought in 1992, I think. Three, maybe, somewhere in there. So that wound up with me, and they have a Mulligan wheel. And
I love the Mulligan wheel. I owned one at one time.
Yeah, and I think
you get parts from anywhere.
I'm sorry.
I said, I love the Mulligan wheel. I owned one at one time. You get the parts anywhere. You go to Granger.
Yeah, it's like the Sea Ray. You can, Granger's your parts department.
Right. It was great. I love it. I had a chance thing, and they were like, it's a 30 seconds of an inch difference. We don't sell it. It's proprietary. Like, ugh.
Mm-hmm. But I will say this, through the years, we've had very few problems with a chance Century wheel. It's been very,
it's a good piece, yeah.
Very reliable. And
there's rumors that they're going to maybe make the Century wheel again. Chance.
I think I've heard that, yes. That'd be a great thing.
$20 million. No, I'm just kidding.
It'll be. I'm sure it'll be over $1.5 million probably. But
That's great. And it's how many feet is it? About 65 or so?
65, 66 if you want to get technical. Yeah. But and it moves okay. You know, if we're right crew, you can do it in 3 hours down and about 5 hours up. But
it's got decent capacity.
Yeah. But
But then you get the Mulligan, it's closer to 80 feet.
That moves pretty quick. It's a truck and a half ride.
Yeah. But you got one with the pup load for the tubs.
Right. And, about 12 years ago, 15 years ago, we bought Jimmy Drew's Alpine Bobs.
Oh, yeah. So
we split the show up. I wound up with it temporarily when it went to Jamie and Sonia and Nikki and Tori, my kids that own the show now. And that's been in winter quarters all winter. They're new scenery, new catwalk. They're really going through the ride. It's a beautiful piece, but it takes too long to move. But I figure they use it for three spots a year. And it's well worth it because it really keeps the lines, you know, chews up the tickets.
Yeah, we were just talking about that. If they could make that one trailer.
Somebody did make a one trailer swing buggy. I don't know if it was Betrazone or somebody had it.
Yeah, it was some of the Europeans made one. Yeah, I think it was Bertizan,
yeah.
Yeah, we were just talking about it, but if Chance could do the one trailer version of that, I'd be.
Yeah, well, we each have a Chance Himalaya, and they move. That's a good ride. People love it. Or it moves quick.
So you both have quite a few Chance pieces. That's interesting. You have a Chance Carousel too, I imagine.
No, we don't have a Chance Himalaya. We have a Wisdom.
A Wisdom. I'm sorry,
I misspoke.
Wisdom. The Wisdom Himalaya.
Yeah.
What are the Chance? Do you both either of you own any Chance pieces anymore or no?
I have a Zipper and the Alpine Box. I don't, but the show has.
Right. You don't have to distance yourself so much from it. Still you.
I still travel with it, but not the whole season.
What about you, Bill? Do you own any Chance pieces still?
The Century wheel. That's it.
It's a Century wheel.
Yeah.
It's amazing. The Champs was such a big, big player.
Boggin, but it went to France, to a carnival in France. And we moved that up till 3 years ago at the Ohio State Fair in 2019, I think, or 18, somewhere in there.
23, I think.
Was that?
22 or 23, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It was after COVID. Okay. It was beautiful. And part of me wish I would have never sold it because it. But on Teardown Night, I'm not so sad that it's gone. But
it's interesting because Chance used to be such a big player in our industry. And and when they kind of pulled out, it left a big void. And you know who it is too, but it got filled quickly with Zamperla. Used to be, they used to, every kiddie ride practically was a Zamperla at one time. And then they kind of pulled back from the carnival business to a certain extent too. Then you had, a lot of the, like you say, a lot of the Italian manufacturers came in and well, Zamperla's Italian too, but really filled the void. But it's going to be interesting with the tariffs, like you're saying, if that's going to affect any more than it already is affecting pricing.
Yeah, God only knows what's going to happen there. But Zamperla had really flashy pieces and they like to ride them. It's just little, they're complex. They're hard to keep going electrically. Little things will shut them down, which I guess is a good thing from a safety point, but when you want to make the ride turn, it's not so great.
I thought you were going to say something.
My kids have been buying these rides from Colmax and Luna Park. The Polish
Colmax sold, I think, 9 spinners in Gibb Town this year. The crazy like dance, that? Whatever they call
overdrive?
It. Yeah, it's a crazy dance or a spinner. It's basically
yeah,
crazy.
Yeah, they got theirs last fall.
Oh, they got one already.
Yeah,
it's a nice piece. They got a good deal if they got it last fall because now they're several hundred thousand dollars more than they were selling for a year ago.
Well, they ordered it before COVID, put money down on it.
Oh,
and that slowed up, and then the price doubled in the meantime. So instead of $300,000, I think they paid over $6,000 for it. But now I imagine it's more than that.
They sold a ton of them at Gibb Town. I couldn't believe how many they sold. It was incredible. They're really doing well. And it goes to show you that if you do bring those rides to Gibb Town and display and promote a little bit, you usually do well. I mean, I think of Colmax and Luna Park. Both came the first year, whenever they came, way back when, pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. And Colmax brought the elephant.
Yeah.
And Luna Park had the same ride, but they didn't bring anything. And Colmax sold a ton of them. But, the people that didn't bring it didn't quite sell as much. And there's definitely something to seeing things and touching them and feeling them and bringing them out there that makes a big difference with what you're doing. Did you guys both go to Gibb Town this year?
I didn't go.
I wasn't there. My son Bobby was down there, but I couldn't make it this year.
Yeah, my son and son-in-law were down there.
Yeah, I saw them actually. Came by the booth a little bit, talked some. So, what other innovations are going on on your shows? Anything using ticketing systems or are you using anything different right now?
I'm not really sure what their plans are. Jamie had his computerized fun card for a while, and I'm not sure they've used it the last 2 years or not. But they keep. They've got a big server and their IT trailer. They got a trailer they call the IT trailer, and it's got an antenna up, so they have a LAN, so everybody can communicate efficiently.
Right.
But I'm not sure if they're upgrading their fun card or not this year.
What about you, Bill? Are you using any electronic ticketing, or are you still using?
No electronic. Well, online purchasing and credit card sales, of course. ATM, but no, we don't have a fun card or anything of that nature.
Yeah, I think, I think for some people it's great and other people it probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
I think to do it right, you have to spend a whole lot of money. And
what are you saving?
I think you have to be above a certain level, actually. And we do well.
Yeah, you got to see the savings in some sense of what you're going to save from making that investment. And, if you got a pretty good handle on things, you're probably not going to save a whole lot anyway. They say ticket sellers, but I'm not, other carnival owners say, I don't really save that much because I have to have people out there to help them and
mm-hmm.
assist with the purchase and do those things. So. So when do you open the season and when does it roll up?
I start the third week of April and we run through September, sometimes the first week into October.
And I think Skirbeck Entertainment Group is opening April 11th and going through the first weekend in October, second weekend in October.
Has that gotten earlier or later over the years?
It's about the same. The weather's been a little nicer the last couple of years.
It has. In the spring, right? It's not just me. It's like, it seems like it's been pretty nice to open in general. Even up there, what kind of temperatures do you catch in April?
Well, if we had to open up here in Escanaba, we'd be pretty cold in April 11th, but they're 300 miles, 400 miles further south, so it's not bad.
That's great.
Probably 60s to answer the question, 50s and 60s.
Okay, so that's not bad at all.
No, it's not terrible. It's winter coat weather in the evening, jacket, sweatshirt weather during the day.
And so when you guys divided, for lack of a better word, did you basically kept the routes that you already had?
Essentially. Yeah, we did. Actually, it was the exact route.
And pretty much the same rides that we had been operating.
Right. So it was just sort of a separation of the
Yeah, there's some exchanges, but
things didn't change a whole lot about, like you said, I'll take that spot and he'll take that spot.
You already
had the spots on your route pretty much. It was just a matter of separating the corporate entity per se.
I think each show is doing better now than when we were partners. I hate to say that, but it just seems like for some reason, your show, Bill's got a beautiful show. His route is got a real solid route and good operation.
We're using a singular as Bill, but I do have, again, my three adult children are very instrumental and their spouses are very, very instrumental in the operation of the business, just to keep that. And then my wife, she's in charge of everybody. So I just want to get that all out there. All right.
Of course. What about concessions? Who operates the food and games and things in your respective shows?
We own all our own games and food.
Really?
And it's managed by different family members, and that changes occasionally. And we seem to like it best that way because we have total control of what's going on.
Yeah.
The downside is you have a larger payroll and quite a few more headaches, quite a few more trucks down the highway.
We start doing that in the 80s, and then there weren't as many independent concessionaires around by that time. You know, when we were kids, it seemed like the whole front end was independent people, you know.
Yeah.
Two or three, somebody had two or three joints, somebody had one joint, you know. And the privilege was cheap. Our show didn't make a lot. Skirbeck Amusement Company, anyhow, didn't make a lot of money on the privilege. It was $16, $17 a week at some spots. But everybody could make a living, evidently, because they kept coming back year after year after year. The regulars did.
But they were down every year.
Yeah. Well, then you got to the fairs where they wanted more money, so we had to charge more money. And when we got up to around the $10, $15 a foot charging people, that was kind of crimped their bottom line. So a lot of them were at retirement age. I just think they quit coming on the road.
What about the food? Is that split pretty equitably?
Well, we each have our own food operation. And how did you mean that, Ron?
Well, I mean, you know, I guess I was getting to a lot of shows that I know well or families that I know well. You know, splitting up the food and seeing who gets what is always sometimes a bone of contention, and who gets what, and, you know, who gets to operate what. And, you know, how do you keep the peace with those sorts of things?
I'll tell you, when my dad and my aunt had the show, there was a lot of contention about who had what rides or who had this and that. So when Bill and I started, we said everything's going to be owned by the company. Nobody's going to have.
And then
good for you.
Yeah. We still do that on our show, and I'm pretty sure he is on your show.
So all boats row in the same direction, as I used to say.
Yeah, it takes a lot of hard feelings out of the way.
It does. I grew up when I my first
job in the business was working with the Vivonas, with the Musicians of America, and they all had popcorns, you know, and when they got to a spot where they'd have to come together, it was all jockeying for a position with the popcorn stand. And I used to say it's such a shame, because, you know, you're all in the same boat, but everybody's rowing in different directions. You know, it'd be nice if everybody could row in the same direction and have a united front, the united goal, because, you know, mm-hmm. when you have independent rides and a lot of shows, not just, you know, the Vivonas, but different people have different rides and different interests, and it divides people, right? I mean, to a certain extent, because how could it not? Because you have something going for you and you make money from it, so it's hard not to pay attention to it, right?
That's exactly what we think. We thought, and it's worked well. We stayed together for 40 years, so I think there's a lot to be said about that.
No, I think that's really brilliant, because a lot of shows don't do that. They, you know, like the kids, oh, he has the food and he has games and she has this and they have that. And then you're kind of, somebody's always measuring up what the other person's making and which is easier and which is better. And why do I have to work all night tearing down the rides when all they have to do is
yeah. stand? Well, there's still a little bit of that about working harder, but.
Okay,
not much.
When they do that, that's fascinating. So everybody's but then you start getting into generations though too, like, you know, how do you involve the grandkids, or how do you involve you know, people that are partners in the enterprise?
I've got 9 grandkids, and the youngest is a freshman in high school, and they've all been working for the show for the last couple, even the youngest one last year. And they work good together, but a lot of them, I'm not sure any of them want to stay in the business. A few of them will probably decide that's the life they want. But some of them, I mean, 9's too many. So some of them are going to have to, and they're all going to college. I mean, the ones, I've got 4 in college and 1 graduated from college already.
Wow.
And.
But that's where kind of those might get under the.
My son got out of business for 5 years and worked for, started at International Paper, and then he went to Mead Paper Company here in Escanaba. And then he met his wife, Sonia. She was an engineer at Mead, environmental engineer. They got married. They fell in love, and then they came on the road, and he got back, and he liked the business. So he says that was where he felt the best. He's a brilliant manager, I think. He's done a lot with the show since I sold it to them. They both have. And my daughters and my son-in-law does a really good job. He's the operations manager, you know, of the rides and stuff. So they do. They work well together. I'm pleased, very pleased.
I was just talking to a person who's like a supplier to the industry, knows everybody. And he was talking about, he's a little older, but he was talking about how many characters there were. He's talking about Gibtown in the old days, how many characters there were in the business. And he says, well, you know, we don't see as much of that now, but I, you know, like you're saying, the people that come back in, I mean, the business now is tough in a lot of ways with the regulations and you can't fly by the seat of your pants anymore. You got to be a little more buttoned up than 20 years ago or 30 years ago, or whatever it was. So it's, I don't know that the people aren't as interesting, because I know plenty of younger people that are pretty interesting in the business, but they seem to have a little more, attention to business and business details, and it makes them probably better operators in the long run. You have to be, because I don't know how you can operate without really paying attention to what you're doing.
Yeah, no, and everybody's got to be kind of specialized. I think, like, my daughter Nicole is specialized in the food operation part of it, and she does real good. A very good job, and she's been knows pretty much just about everything there is to know about making money with food operation. And then with the office person, she's also in the office, and my daughter-in-law's in the office, and my wife's in the office, yet she still works. That's why I travel yet. I get lonely at home by myself.
You know a lot about the show that you're supposedly not too involved with.
What was that?
I said, you know a lot about this show that you're supposedly not too involved with.
Yeah, I know. I noticed that.
Yeah. What about you, Bill? Everybody has their roles. Who plays the big roles on your show?
All 3 of my children and their spouses are, there's a huge amount of paperwork. So there's three of them in the office, and they're taking care of that, the three women, as it turns out. And the guys are out on the midway. Currently, my son Bobby takes care of the games, and son Dustin takes care of the rides, and my son-in-law Jeff takes care of the food trailers, and I stay around just enough to get in the way and slow everything down so they don't make too many mistakes, right? And
but you all share in the revenue or the product of the whole company, right?
That's correct.
So is there like, you know, some sort of interaction between, hey, how are the concessions doing? Like does the person doing the rides have a little bit of, you know, input, I guess is the best way to, into how things work, or does everybody just keep their own specialty? Well, that's it.
I think everybody has their opinions and they share them. And then there are times everybody says, stay in your lane, but we're fortunate that they all communicate and we all get along. And we've been Skirbeck family now for 10 years, and pretty soon, not too far down the road, I'll be out of the picture, I'm sure. And then the kids are going to go and run with it, and I'm sure they'll do just fine. And grandkids on my end aren't too much of a factor now. My oldest grandson is 16, and I have five of them around the age 8 category, a little younger, a little older, but so we're a little ways away from worrying about the grandchildren. But they all travel. We're all on the road together, so it's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. And it's pretty cool how, you know, the carnival business in general is able to pass down through so many generations, because it's so unusual in business. You know, I have an MBA, and I studied all kinds of succession businesses like that. And, you know, most don't, 2 years, you know, two generations, maybe three, but you know, you guys are 7, and there's plenty of examples of 3 and 4 and 5 in our industry, which is pretty remarkable. It really is remarkable. And then, you know, to see the people that run it now, is impressive. I've seen some show owners and show owners' sons and daughters that are, really doing great things with the shows. You think of, think a name like Blake Houston is, you know, I don't even know how he even gets his mind around what the heck that enterprise is about, but.
It's huge. They are huge. Very successful.
Yeah, that's one of a kind. I mean, that's unique in the industry, having that many major dates and that much equipment. It's a whole different story.
But him and Danny don't seem insane. They seem like they have pretty good lives. They go through things, so they must have a handle on it with good
people. They got to figure it out, that's for sure. Mm-hmm.
There's quite a few that have multiple units, and how they keep track and run the shows. It's pretty neat. You see a lot of kids coming up. The Reithoffers are another one that have kids coming up that are doing a pretty good job with whatever. The Vivonas kind of made it. Now their cousins' kids are looking at things. There's plenty of examples. There's so many examples. It's incredible, really.
You know, it's interesting, Ron, if you ever go back to get like an early amusement business, like from the mid-60s, look at the route listings. And it's amazing how many shows are listed and how many are still in business.
Yeah, there's a lot. And if you know their names and a little history, they may have been in business, but just under a different name, or, you know, like a Playland, whoever you bought out, you know, it still exists in a way. It just was bought out, you know.
Yeah. So, actually, we have some of the same equipment from it yet, but not too much.
Right. And you're playing the same route and doing the same things as you did. And but there, it's not a whole lot different. You know, some of the East Coast shows that I know. Well, East Coast hasn't changed a whole lot. When you think about it, you got Straits and Degler and Breithoffer and Amusements of America. And, you know, most of the bigger shows are still there. And you got some new guys like Dreamland and some of the other ones that came about. But there's a lot of the same shows. West Coast, at least in my, you know, since like the early 90s, has changed more that I've seen than the East. Because I remember it used to be like B&B and Larry Davis and some of those shows. Now, RCS was just starting to really come into being huge at that time.
Right.
They are, obviously. And Butler's always around, but there's been a little bit, at least in my opinion, there's been a little bit more turnover way out west than there has been Midwest and East.
Yeah,
although Midwest had quite a bit of turnover too.
Big one recently is Pat Crabtree selling a show.
Yes.
Getting out of the business. And
to AMP.
Huh?
To AMP. right? Amp, Amusement
Midway. Yeah. But you know that they didn't buy the whole route. They bought some of it. Some of it they folded into the route.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
And they didn't buy all the equipment either.
I didn't know that.
But yeah, so the Mary Talley got some of that. I don't know if she got it before they split up or not, but she's playing San Angelo and Louisiana, Shreveport. And I just think it's different. It's a different way of doing it, kind of.
Yeah, no question about it. It's a, but you're right. A lot of the routes and a lot of the places are the same as they were not, you know, a long time ago, really. In a lot of ways, it's, you know, the change is, I mean, you don't have Royal American anymore. You don't have, you know, some of the other bigger players, but people have come in to change, you know, to take those Blit Murphy brothers, but people have come in to take their steps. And then you had name kind of swallow up three or four or five carnivals. So, they, you know, because sometimes when they say there's so many less carnivals, I mean, I think that's true to a little bit, but, you know, I don't know. It seems like there's a lot of even in Gibb Town. You know, and I interact with a lot of shows and a lot of things during the course of the year, and there's always four or five or six shows I never heard of that come up to Gibb Town or go someplace. And they, you know, so I think there's people getting into business, maybe not in a huge way, or at least they don't start in a big way like everybody.
But the bug. If they work hard, they can start with, you know, seven or eight rides, and pretty soon they got 15, and pretty soon they got 35 or 40. You know, it just depends how aggressive they are.
Yeah, well, I always tease that they start out nice and smart with a little compact route and make it nice and easy, and then they get a little bit of the bug, and they they start to move and get big, and they say, oops. I had a guy probably 20 years ago, 15 years ago, played up northeast, and he's like, I want to go south. I said, why would you want to go south? Well, you know, they extend the route and you go. I say, God, you got a nice life up there. You're done. It's October. You know, you play a couple of spots and some Halloween dates. You get done. Be done with it. You come south, you're going to compete with everybody else, fighting with, you know, a giant show that you have to compete with all these fairs, and you're not going to make any money. It's crazy. But, and then, he's tried it for a few years. He still does it. But he's like, I think you're right. I should have just stayed up there and ended the season, you know, when it was over. Because that's one of the bigger changes I see is, like, you know, guys like you would just end when you end. You know, you probably wind down a little in September and then you're done in October and you're done. But, you know, so many guys like start to operate year round, and that's a whole different, ballgame.
It is. And we're very comfortable doing what we do. We work year round, of course. We have a shop and go through our equipment. And,
sure.
You know, we do take a little travel time, vacation time, whatever, but. We all have our own economies of scale, and you got to kind of watch that the spot that you really think you need, you probably don't, if you have to go out and spend a couple $1 million or $3 million to satisfy the contract to be at the same place financially as you are before you got the things. So.
Yeah, that's, you know, I'd say, Bill, you think the same way as I do a little bit to certain things, but I was thinking about shows that have two or three or four sometimes big spots, but that's their whole route.
Mm-hmm.
And like they spend their whole life protecting those couple of spots, because if they don't have them, they're done. You know, I mean, maybe not done, but they're kind of done in a way. And it's gotta be scary. It's gotta be nerve wracking. You know, every time something comes up, and I was thinking about like Royal and, you know, with Minnesota and spots that they had, and it just, you spend your whole life holding those spots. And it's much nicer if you have a bunch of spots that are kind of the same. So, okay, I lost one. Okay, I'll get another one. It's no big deal, you know.
But it's always a big deal because, you know, you always have a good spot and you always want to have a good spot. But if you lose a good one, it pinches. But
not catastrophic.
Like, again, like you keep your
$5 million fare or something like
right, that. Right. That's again, economies of scale. Keep it there.
That's good advice. That's very good advice with things. So what's anything new on the horizon, or are you just guys just happy to be doing? You get lived a great life. I mean, what a great family history of the show, and Arlene's history, and it's just amazing what you guys have done. And I'm glad to hear you're going to be or at least your kids and maybe your grandkids will be continuing it too.
I believe so. New on the horizon, I can't speak for Joe's family, Jamie and John and them, but we haven't bought a new ride, but we're buying bunkhouses and trucks and tractors, and we got a generator being delivered and some new bumper cars. And so we're investing, and who knows what tomorrow will bring.
What about you guys? Have you guys bought anything new lately? Or?
Well, I think they bought a few things at Gibtown this year. They bought a new bunkhouse, and I think they got a couple of Zamperla pieces, kiddie rides, one animal, and maybe some stuff out in the future they put deposits on.
And they'll get it in 2036 or something.
Yeah, the grand
2027.
You just got to take out a life insurance policy on the owner of the ride manufacturer now. Yeah. Make sure they last that long. You know, it's kind of crazy. Sorry.
I do have a trailer mounted scrambler coming. I forgot about
it. Yeah, Jamie does too. Jamie and John have one coming also. I think it'll be picked up this spring, actually. It's ready.
Eli Bridge? Well, thank you so much for sharing the history of the show. It's fascinating. You got to be one of the oldest shows out there. I don't know too many shows.
I think it's the oldest name in the outdoor amusement business.
I think so.
We never missed a season except for COVID, and we didn't really miss that. We had food, independent, you know, we took our food and put them for drive-through food up. So we were on the road every year since 1884 in this country.
Yeah, I mean, pre-1900, it's almost impossible to trace a show. I mean, the most you could have had was a merry-go-round or something.
We can trace ours pretty well. I've got the routes yet from the 1890s.
That's amazing.
With the circus, anyhow. And then,
yeah.
He gave a really long interview with the White Tops magazine just before he passed away in 1953, before he died. But he gave the interview was in 53, and there's a lot of information in there that's useful. And now with the research tools that are available through AI, I plan on following up on it. I'm try to track everything down.
I think that's great. Well, thank you guys so much for joining me. I really appreciate it, and sharing the history of Skirbeck.
Thank you for having us, Ron.
Yeah, it's nice seeing you again.
Just keep us, abreast. If your kids are dividing the shows more, we have to keep the scorecard.
Okay.
I've got a giant Skirbeck family tree in my my office that the branches keep getting longer and longer, wider and wider.
We'll update you annually.
Thanks so much, guys.
Bye. This podcast is brought to you by Innovative Ticketing. Is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Our staff of professionals can guide you through your setup, assist with customer service, even on the weekends when you most need it, and help increase your sales through promotions that work. Innovative Ticketing is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Sign up today at innovativeticketing.com.